Despite the fairly constant arguments about logging in our part of the world, forest land is regulated in the United States, certainly regulated more strictly than in many other countries. In some parts of the world, forest land disappears at an alarming rate. By some estimates, the Amazon rainforest alone loses 20,000 acres a year. A recent piece in the news shows how high avocado prices in Mexico make it attractive to clear forests for tree plantations. And our first guests today looked at economic and policy drivers for deforestation in another part of Latin America. The guests are Jan Lepolan de Waru, who's a postdoctoral research fellow at Stanford. Jan, thanks for joining us today.
Hi.
And Rachel Garrett is with us as well. She's an assistant professor at Boston University. They are the first two authors listed in a piece called Land Use Policies and Corporate Investments in Agriculture in the Gran Chaco and Chiquitano, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Rachel, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the conversion of forest land to farmland, obviously well known. Was your research aimed at finding how much or where, or what was the starting point? Jan, let's start with you.
Hi. The research that we conducted was not so much about how much, but how do people who deforest land in those regions make decisions about deforesting it, and where do they choose to invest? Because they deforest for not just for the sake of deforestation, but for producing commodities, which are mostly soybeans and beef. And so we wanted to understand better why they produce in certain places. And especially what's the influence of land use regulations and deforestation regulations and restrictions on those choices.
Rachel Garrett, to come back to a wide view, I mean, is there a case to be made that with more people on the planet, there must be more land available for agriculture?
Well, not necessarily. So we are studying both soybeans and cattle ranching. And in Latin America, cattle ranching is very extensive, meaning that it requires a lot of land to produce a very little amount of food. And, you know, one of the attributes of our study is that it was digging into the differences between cattle and soy, and we found that cattle ranchers are typically more deforestation intensive, and they require incorporating cheaper forested land to sort of make a profit. But the whole goal of sort of combating deforestation in Latin America is oriented around changing that strategy for cattle ranchers and creating more opportunities for them to stay on the previously cleared land and invest in the soil fertility there rather than seeking out these higher fertility forested lands just temporarily before moving on to new forest areas.
Temporarily because they will, what, leave this land behind and move on, or what?
Right, exactly. So instead of investing in fertilizers and forage seeds for, you know, better grasses and the health of their cattle, what they'll often do is just sort of leave the cattle out with very low management on these pastures that have this residual fertility from the forest and not invest in it at all, and then seek out new areas that have, you know, clear new areas, and then rely on the new fertility of that area instead of investing in sort of replacing the fertility that they extract by grazing their cattle there.
Wow, it sounds almost like throwaway forest, where they use up the fertility that came with it as it was forest, transitioning to farmland, and then move on when it wears out.
Exactly.
So in terms of making a comparison, Rachel, between soy and beef, I know we've heard a lot about, and you mentioned just briefly about how much land it takes to grow beef. Is it like pound for pound of protein, do you get a lot more out of soy than you do out of beef on the same land?
Well, it definitely depends on what you're using the soy for. So if you're using the soy with corn to feed chickens or pigs, you do actually get a lot more out of the land area in terms of how much protein and calories you produce. Versus any sort of ungulate, we call them, that relies more on grassless, so like sheep or cattle, they're going to be less efficient in converting that land into protein.
Our guests on the Jefferson Exchange are researchers Rachel Garrett and Jan Lepolan de Waru, who worked together at Stanford and put out a piece about deforestation and deforestation havens, as they're called, in parts of South America. We'll get into specifically where in just a moment. You can join our discussion about how deforestation can be encouraged or discouraged through policy and economics. 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jan, can you tell us approximately where it was that you focused your work, where in the world?
Yeah, that's a region called the Gran Chaco and the Chiquitano. That's it's a sort of dry forest ecosystem that spans between northern Argentina and parts of Bolivia and Paraguay. It's a relatively little known area, although in the last few years, because of the very high rates of deforestation, it's kind of come under the radar. Mostly conservation was focused on the Amazon until recently.
So is this area perhaps seeing more deforestation because of the intense scrutiny on the Amazon? I mean, so did some of the companies that might have been involved in the Amazon move to the Gran Chaco and Chiquitano?
The direct movement of companies from the Amazon to the Gran Chaco and Chiquitano is probably pretty marginal from what I've seen in the region. There aren't a lot of companies that were involved in both areas or coming from one to the next. But the restrictions in the Amazon create a macroeconomic effect that might push some producers to invest in the Chaco rather than in the Amazon. So it might not be a direct displacement of people, but it might still have a sort of indirect effect on investments in the Chaco. We're actually looking at that now in a sort of follow-up study, but it's hard to say yet whether that's actually an effect.
And in which countries are we talking about in the Gran Chaco and Chiquitano?
Bolivia, Paraguay, and Argentina.
Okay, Bolivia, Paraguay, Argentina. And had the land been ever logged, or was it virgin forest that was being converted to farmland there?
No, the concept of virgin forest is probably doesn't apply much there. It's a relatively well-preserved forest in parts of the region, but it has experienced several booms of resource extraction, and one of those booms was in the past selectively logging trees that were used for tannins. So there's a tree called quebracho. Throughout the area that was heavily logged. So it's a forest that has already been affected to a large extent by extractive activities. And that's also an argument that a lot of people use to justify converting it to agriculture, saying that it's actually not so valuable anymore.
How good are the ecosystems, though, even though it is second, maybe even third growth? I mean, do you have a fair number of critters that were indigenous to the land still living there?
Yeah, and it isn't really second growth. That is, it hasn't been clear cut in most of the areas, but it has been selectively logged. It is still very valuable for mammifers, in among others. There's the jaguar is endemic to the area and is actually heavily threatened. It's almost disappeared from Argentina. It's still pretty widespread in Paraguay and Bolivia. There's a lot of other animals that depend on the forest, and it is definitely not true that just because it has been partially logged, it is worthless today and should be cut.
So quality ecosystem there still. So we have a sense of place and approximate activity here. Rachel Garrett, can you walk us into what the method and the research was? It looked like you did a lot of interviews here.
Well, that's probably a question best addressed by Jan, because he's the first author on the study and actually spent months in the field. So I'll defer that one to him.
Okay.
The methods. Okay. There's a lot of different elements to it, but I'll maybe start with the interviews. I interviewed a lot of people down there. The way I went about it was contacting relatively large producers who are responsible for deforestation through agricultural associations and lobbies, and then contacting producers that knew the producers I interviewed. So we call that snowball sampling. You ask every one person that you interview for other phone numbers of people they know and go on like this. And then what we did was collecting information about their activities and their investments in land, and based on that, conducting a statistical analysis of what the factors were that influenced the investment choices that they made. And that's a statistical analysis, and it's also completed by qualitative analysis of how they talked about places. And so for each mention in an interview that they make of a certain place, we also look at what attributes they associate with this place. For instance, if people talking about Bolivia always talked about insecurity or about fertile lands, that's something we then analyzed for the whole region.
We are talking about deforestation through policy in the places called Gran Chaco and Chiquitano in Bolivia, Paraguay, and Argentina with two of the chief researchers on a study about the effects of policy on deforestation. And you can join this discussion on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's understand the scale of production here. We're talking about farmers who then sell their goods to other people up a producer chain of several steps. Are we talking about investments by large companies here?
Right. Well, we're talking about large companies that invest in producing and they sell their products to bigger companies. There are traders that then trace those products to buyers in mostly, if you're talking about soy, it's mostly in Asia. Beef, it's in different places, including Russia, the Middle East, the U.S. also. So those companies sometimes engage in both. They can be producers, but also have parts of a processing plant. We're talking about relatively large producers with land in the order of 1,000 to 100,000 acres for one company.
Just to chime in here. One of the issues that makes this such a difficult problem to regulate is that there are so many different producers, and in comparison to other agricultural processes and manufacturing processes, there's just millions of farmers that you have to try to address when it comes to soy and cattle, in comparison to something like oil palm, where these really large companies tend to own the plantations and you can sort of more directly focus on these really large international companies. I mean, even though we're talking about farms that are 1,000 hectares, which might sound very large, this is over a landscape of, 20 million to 100 million hectares, depending on the country. And so it is quite a lot of actors that we're talking about here.
Is there any global view, any sense of I cleared 5 hectares and 5 hectares here and there and there and there add up over the planet? Or is it just a strict local focus on what I need to do for my well-being?
Do you mean now from the perspective of people actually engaged in producing?
Right on the landscape, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's interesting because the way they tend to conceive of this is not so much a concern for the adding up of deforestation, but their discourse is often focused on food production and the need for the growing needs of a growing population worldwide for food. And that's how a lot of producers say morally justify their actions and the fact that they're cutting down forests to satisfy a demand. So that's a sort of interesting way that they use discourse.
And there's definitely a very interesting story that you hear repeated. I work primarily in Brazil rather than the region that this study was focused on, but there's this understanding that the United States cleared all of the native vegetation in the Midwest to promote crop and cattle production there, and it's a double standard for the international community to hold the producers in South America to a different standard than these very countries pursued when they were developing their economy.
So, in other words, the United States can stand on a moral high ground now, perhaps, but 150
exactly.
years ago, a different story.
That is a very strong discourse that you hear also in the Chaco, I'm sure in Brazil, very often, is who are you to tell us not to... So say to develop when you guys all did that in Europe, in the U.S. 100 or 200 years ago.
We are talking to the authors of a report from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences called Land Use Policies and Corporate Investments in Agriculture in the Gran Chaco and Chiquitano. It's basically a look at economic and governmental policies that encourage or discourage deforestation. The chief authors, we're numbers one and two, are with us today. Jan Lepolin de Waru is a postdoctoral research fellow at Stanford. Rachel Garrett is an assistant professor at Boston University. We'll spend a couple more minutes with them, and you can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. 3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Rachel, I'm glad to hear that you worked in Brazil, too, so there's a broader perspective than just Gran Chaco and Chiquitano. And I wonder if you have a sense now across several countries of what policies exist that might be actually encouraging deforestation.
Well, it's really about the differences in policies between regions, and not just between countries, but within countries, even between different ecosystems. So there's something that we call in academia the high forest bias, which means that people tend to be concerned with tropical humid forests and less concerned with the dry forests like the Chaco Chiquitano, and definitely less concerned with the savanna-like ecosystems, which also exist in the region, in particular in Brazil. So what really matters is the difference in how you regulate different types of forest and how you regulate differently across countries that are located so closely to each other. And so the whole point of this research was that it showed that in these really these tightly sort of linked regions that you see actors moving to the less regulated regions, assuming that all of the places, given that all of the places are actually suitable for both soy and cattle production, farmers will just go to the one that's closest to where they currently are, that's the least regulated.
It's a bias toward certain kinds of landscapes. Some kinds of forest are seen as worth less than others.
Right. So the Amazon is seen as worth more because it not only has, you know, high biodiversity, but also the highest carbon stocks and has just sort of captured the imagination of the international community in a way that other biomes haven't. And so that's the most regulated of any of the regions across the board, across the country, and across South America. And so the questions that we investigate together, Jan and I, are what sort of movements do we see of actors between the Amazon, out of the Amazon, into other regions that are less regulated, including movements between the Amazon and the savanna called the Cerrado, and between the Cerrado and the Grand Chaco and Chiquitano area.
We have a couple. Go ahead, Jan.
Sorry, yeah. No, I was going to say, and by the way, there's a very easy way to see that bias. If you want to just Google, there's something that we did for another study, just Google deforestation in each of those biomes, deforestation Amazon, deforestation Chaco, and you can see the number of results that you get. And we did that just to kind of make explicit that bias, and you see a huge list of results for the Amazon and very few over the years for the Chaco or for the Cerrado or Caatinga or some other important ecosystems of South America.
Okay, I got a couple calls here for you. Let's go first to Anne in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jan Lepolin de Waru and Rachel Garrett.
Thank you. All of this is being driven by overpopulation. If we don't deal with overpopulation, we're going to destroy the biosphere that supports human beings and all other higher life forms. So when are we going to start dealing with that problem instead of ignoring it as we're doing now? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Anne. Appreciate that. Any one of you want to take that one on?
Sure. I'll leave you lead, Rachel.
Okay.
I'll go after.
So there is a definitely less of a willingness to talk about the demand side pressures that affect these ecosystems rather than the supply side. And what I mean is we tend to try to focus, for some reason, more on the farmers themselves rather than tackling the consumers who are ultimately driving these processes. And so part of the equation is the number of people on this planet, but the other part of the equation is really what they're consuming per person. And so the bigger issue, it's widely accepted, I would say, that the bigger issue is not how many people necessarily there are on the planet, but how much they consume per person, and that because a lot of the preferences of people have been changing as they get wealthier, they're demanding more meat products. And it's really this change away from vegetarian diets towards meat-oriented diets that's driving this demand, this increased demand for chickens, for pigs, for beef, and all of those tend to require large amounts of land, either directly for grazing or indirectly to produce the soy and corn that goes into feeding those chickens and pigs.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Time enough to squeeze in one more call here from Charmaine and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, you actually just pointed out the reason I called, and that was first, overpopulation, and secondly, the rising middle class around the world, especially like China, who are driving this increase towards beef eating. But again, I don't think you can minimize the population part of it. We've more than doubled since the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no matter what someone eats, when you get those many people, your aquifers are dropping. India's aquifers are dropping horribly. The point is we need to start talking about population. It was a topic that everyone talked about with the advent of the birth control pill and Paul Ehrlich's mm-hmm. population bomb.
Right.
And I think we need to not be afraid to do that.
All right. Thanks
anymore.
For that, Charmaine. Appreciate that.
I certainly push it.
Okay. Thanks, Charmaine. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
sorry.
John.
No, I just want to make a point about this first, or maybe two. In terms of consumption, there's also a strong local consumption component for beef. So a lot of the beef that's produced in the region is consumed by those countries. Another point about population is it's interesting. It has also a justice or north-south component, as we talked earlier, in the sense that whether you put the focus on consumption or on population kind of shifts whether you care more about what others do, for instance, China, or what is done here. And I think if you put the focus more on consumption, then it makes it also clear that we have a strong responsibility for those processes as consumers in Western countries because of our very high level of consumption. Whereas mm-hmm. if you mostly focus on population, then it ends up also kind of being a blame game for other countries that have strong population growth.
Okay, we have learned a lot today about the pressures that lead to deforestation from Jan Lapalande-Waru and Rachel Garrett. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for having us.